Run for your lives! It's the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. This Medicare podcast has no excuse, sir. He never tires of exciting insurance chat. Medicare expert Doug Jones.
Why, thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us for the Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. And thank you for Drew McMillan for quaint but yet enthusiastic intro. I'm always happy to hear that voice at the beginning of our episodes, and frankly, may it ever be thus. So as I said, Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast, as Drew said, I am Doug Jones, your Medicare expert for today. Medicare expert and bon vivant. Vivanting you want to have done, then I'm probably, but we're very happy to have you with us for a little Medicare talk and a little goofing around talk, usually do. It's been a while since I've defined the lazy man that I'm podcasting. That person would be any man or woman, could be a lazy lady, who is reluctant to have to study Medicare. People approaching Medicare age often feel as though they're compelled to learn every possible fact about Medicare, learn about every possible plan, every possible choice they can make, and it becomes an overwhelming, kind of a scary task. And our job is to lighten that, relieve that burden, to let you know that there are only two or three major decisions that have to be made for most people. And when you are able to get the information pared down way, a slimmed down, a shorthand kind of way, the way we do it, then those decisions become that much. There isn't as much. Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast is designed to deliver the minimum amount of Medicare knowledge that you need to make the right decision. Hopefully, helping me in that task is a man who has been socially distant for years and years, Randy Carson. Randy, talk to us.
When I heard about social distancing, Doug, most recently about the COVID-19, it was no big change for me. I have been socially distant for most of my life, but I do have to tell you a story. I was looking out my office window, and I see, I'm assuming, a couple that lives in my neighborhood. I'm not familiar with them, but I saw a man and a woman walking down the street, each holding on to the end of a 6-foot chain.
Did you run out and measure it?
No, well, I didn't. I should have, to make sure they were in compliance.
There are places where the neighbors have taken over the policing duties. And frankly, you know, there's a lot of vigilantism going on out there, I'm told. For some reason, one of these web chit-chat things, you know, like Facebook would be, where a bunch of strangers go on and yell at stuff at each other all day long. Some woman said, "Okay, you people with multiple cars in your driveways during Easter, I see you. I know who you are. You're not practicing social distance, are you? You're socializing." And then people started posting pictures of Gladys Kravitz in response to her. So I thought, maybe that'll shut her up. We don't need any more people like that in an area where there are almost no cases of the virus. Frankly, we have so few in this area. Conceive of anybody getting sick.
I was going to ask you, though, Doug, given the fact that we've been told to stay at least 6 feet away from each other, number one is what was that couple going to do when they got to the house? And number two, and at least another point would be, I've always had the expression of, I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Is that kind of the same thing?
Well, it's easier to push a pole than it would be to push a chain. That's the first thing that comes to mind. And the other thing that comes to mind is when you tell me about people like this, I have to believe that they're kind of dopey because maybe they think the order only applies if they're outside the house. And when they're inside the house, life goes on as normal. I don't know. I'm just speculating here. But we have a neighbor lady who drives by in the same stupid PT Cruiser I've seen for decades. almost decades since I've owned this house, a decade and a half. And she started driving around in the car by herself with a bandana on. And she really does look like one of the Jesse James gang headed off to the Great Northfield, Minnesota raid. But she's in her car by herself. I don't understand the kind, but I suppose it makes as much sense as hoarding toilet. So if you
think she might have been going to grab some more toilet paper.
Possibly so. And frankly, this lady would need more than her share of toilet, I believe. And I hate to think about that. If anybody in our neighborhood needs it, it's probably. I think I told you about my grandmother when she started going senile. She
developed a very, very close relationship with stockpiling toilet paper.
I was afraid that was going to be my inheritance. I was waiting. And she went off to the nursing home. I was afraid that that's what I was going to be have delivered to me. Here you go. Here's your share.
Now, I mean, if you think about it now, Doug, that might not have been a bad idea.
Well, the other thing is, you think so, but I told you about the horrible experience I had about 3 or 4 years ago. All of my life, which is every few years, the cost of a postage stamp goes up. And back when I was a kid, it would go up from like 2 cents to three, maybe 3 cents to 4 cents. And that was a big deal, big news. And then it'd stay at 4 cents for 10 years. Then we'd go to 5 cents. Oh my God, the world's going to come to an end. And then obviously lately it's been changing frequently. Well, I went out and bought as many forever stamps as the local post office had. I said, this is like money in the bank. It's like savings bonds. I bought forever stamps, tons, buckets of forever stamps, and brought them home. And within a month, the post office had announced its budget for the following year, and they cut the cost of a stamp by 1 or 2 cents. I forget what it was.
Cut the cost of a stamp?
Yeah, this was just a few years ago.
I don't remember where they have ever gone down.
First time in history. And of course, that made all of my forever stamps completely worthless, virtually worth less than they had been.
Oh, so you had a reverse Ponzi going there?
Yeah, pretty much. They saw me coming, and they took advantage of my interest in maximizing my investment value.
Well, you know, nowadays I don't know how much mailing you do, but what is it?
I have people to do that for me.
Yeah, business. Well, I have people too. And it's called me, but. What are they, like 50 cents for business right now, like metered rate?
Well, I don't know because I don't have a meter. And when I send my people to the post office, I basically am just, I don't care what I pay. I'm just happy to have some solitude.
I just wanted to tell you, Doug, that last week my meter told me this isn't going to work anymore. And it started printing installment loan contracts on the back of my envelopes that I have to fill out now.
Well, I've heard that machines like that, and especially commercial printers, like I used to have in my office when I was a regional manager for big time insurance companies, would store all of the documents that they printed, that all of that stuff. So apparently yours decided to spit out all the knowledge it had stored up.
Yeah, well, it didn't get it from me because I only use it to print mail envelopes, but crazy sort of thing.
Is it a Pitney Bowes?
Well, yeah, they're the only game in town. It really is. You talk about an absolute monopoly. Pitney Bowes is the only meter in town, has always been the only meter in town, and it's the only place you can buy the ink for them.
We had a Pitney Bowes postage meter in our office when I started in the 70s. I would have to take the guts of it off of the machine, put it in a special Pitney Bowes suitcase, and haul it over to the post office, across a couple of streets. Summer, that was good duty. That was nice excuse to get out of the office for a while. In the wintertime, you'd stand in line at the special window, and then you'd have 3 or 4 people that would be in charge, and they didn't look at the customer. They just opened it up and started yelling things out, and then the other person writing notes in the book repeat the information, and I'd stand there being ignored, and they'd finally lock it up, put a new seal on it, and shove it back across the counter, and I'd go on my way for a while.
Well, you know how that works now? Pretty much the same way, except for you can refill your meter online.
Oh.
But, I mean, literally, it's very similar. It's very tight. It's very tight security-wise. But the problem is the meter is only worth about $12. I'm teasing a little bit, but the meter is worth $12. But the ink, every ink cartridge is like $412. I'm being a little facetious, but
Wow. Well, we just beat the cost of ink in Hewlett-Packard printers by signing up for their ink program where they mail me cartridges.
Yes.
And turns out that I pay $10 a month, and then they mail me all the ink I can use, assuming that I've guessed correctly as to my usage. But the cartridges they send us are like the capacity of the
one. Yeah.
It's fantastic. Yeah. So maybe there's a secret program like that that Pitney Bowes has for you that you would all.
I'd like to find it, because obviously, as you know, you really need it when it runs out.
Oh, sure. That's the one time it runs out is when you are in the middle of doing something important.
Exactly.
Well, the unfortunate part of this whole story is that you don't get the opportunity like I did on a warm summer day to walk across the loop, get some popcorn from the pretty college girls at the popcorn stand outside the first day, or get the free cartons or packs of cigarettes that the girls used to pass out on the corners to anybody walking by. You don't get to enjoy all of that like I used to.
I know. I totally understand. At least I don't have to ride down to the post office and stand in line and get hollered at to get it filled up again.
There you go. So
Speaking of doing things electronically.
Yes, sir.
My notes here are that we're going to delve into the relationship between Medicare and telemedicine.
I'm pretty excited about this. I thought, okay, boy, because I got this question from your crack staff. And your crack staff spends a lot of time online at the post office, I'm gathering. But this is a subject that once I delved into it, I realized, I think, is the cusp of a new era or a step forward into modern times from the tradition-bound practice of medicine that we all grew up with. And this kind of thing wasn't really apparent to people. I think it might be because I was a curmudgeonly child, that when I discovered a fact of medical treatment and medical ethics and so forth, I was perturbed by it because it didn't seem right to me, but I couldn't do anything about it because I was a 12-year-old kid when I learned. The older I got, the less I thought about it. But this subject that we're talking about today kind of brings it all flooding back. I remember a time when somebody in my family was supposed to take medical records to a different doctor for some reason, and I don't remember why. Our family doctor back in the 1950s lived across down the road and across. So we were all out in the country. So he was probably a quarter of a mile away. If a kid in the family had the measles, or he would stop by with his little black bag and get out his stethoscope and, you know, do his thing, prescribe whatever medicine was required. And then he would go down and join my parents in pouring cocktails for hours because, frankly, it was a convenient excuse to do a little socializing. And that house call probably cost bucks. And every time, there were five kids in our family, so there were probably a lot of house calls and a lot of alcohol poured over ice at the bar. The important thing was that he was a kind of a transparent guy. If something was wrong with somebody, we all knew about it. There wasn't any need for privacy or anything. However, doctors were on a pedestal. If you had medical records that were necessary for you to do something with, you had to ask for those records to be heard directly from the doctor that had them to the doctor that needed them, and you weren't allowed to take possession of them. I saw this more than once, and it was an antiquated, kind of a stuck-up way of approaching patient treatment. Like, okay, these records are way above your pay grade. You're just really not capable of understanding. If I let you see them, you might misunderstand the nature of the, it's best that you not be bothered, you know, pretty little head with this medical information that we have compiled upon your time as a patient. The only time I ever saw a guy with his medical records with him was when I went through my draft. As my friend Seamus Carney had brought this thick, giant file of medical records, hoping that an officer would take the time to read it and find something. They didn't tell him to go away, and he wasn't suitable for the Army. That didn't happen. He turned out he was found unsuitable for the Army because he had size 15 clodhoppers with bones and protrusions. He had the ugliest feet in the world. And in fact, the doctor looking at feet called all the other doctors over and said, look at these things. Wow. And they threw him right out. So he just merry way. But it was irritating to me that doctors would not permit the person whose medical records they owned see them or to transport them. Now, over the years, that sort of got relaxed and medical records became available for people. But there was another thing that kind of bothered me. As modern technology widespread, even into the rural parts of the country, I always thought, why your doctor? I used to, once in a while, like every couple of years, I'd get a case of strep throat or I'd have the flu or something. And if I thought going to see a doctor would be helpful, I would have to, first of all, somehow weasel an appointment with some doc. And then I would have to drag my sorry butt out of the bed and actually get, you know, showered and sort of decent looking, get dressed. And especially if it's winter time, you'd have to go sit in the doctor's office, be miserable there. Finally, the doctor would look at you, maybe take your temperature, which you could do at home, then prescribe something or tell you that it would just have to run its course. Sometimes they would take a culture to diagnose what you had, like strep throat. But the whole point was you could have been able to do most of that stuff over the telephone. You could have described your symptoms. Every house had a thermometer. Every house had a pesky mother always feeling your forehead. So there was the telemetry was there. All you had to do was convey it to the doctor for him to use his experience to diagnose the problem. And it just always has disturbed me that that wasn't a common way of dealing with medical treatment that could lower the cost and become so much more convenient, especially as people get older and they don't want to get out of the house. They would probably do just as well checking in on a routine basis for doctors' follow-up visits electronically. And finally, that technology is being used for the first time. Thank you, President Trump, for on March 17th, I've got an article here. President Trump expands telehealth benefits. Telehealth is what we're talking about here. President Trump expands telehealth benefits for medical beneficiaries. And I think this is just another step forward in reducing the cost of delivery of medical care, making things a lot more efficient, finding people to get out and drive around to and from the doctor's office, waiting for an appointment. This is, I think, a big step forward in the comfort and quality of care for patients today. And just a few highlights of this article so that I can explain what it is. Trump administration today announced expanded Medicare telehealth coverage that will enable beneficiaries, that's you, you're like a beneficiary to a recipient of welfare. Medicare beneficiaries are theoretically a different, but I use the term Medicare participants. Anyway, they will be able to receive a wider range of healthcare services from their doctors without having to travel to a healthcare, it's not travel to the same one the doctor is located in. Prior to this announcement, Medicare was only allowed to pay clinicians for telehealth services such as routine. For example, the beneficiary receiving the services must live in a rural area and travel to a local medical facility to get telehealth services from a doctor in a remote location. In order to qualify for this benefit, you had to get your sorry butt out of your house and go to a local medical facility in order to correspond electronically with a doctor in an even more faraway location. In addition, that person, the patient, would generally not be allowed to receive telehealth services in their home. Is that ridiculous or what? Well, that seems to be now. The Trump administration previously expanded. Over the last 2 years, Medicare expanded the ability for clinicians to have brief check-ins with their patients through phone, video chat, and online patient portals, referred to as virtual check-ins. And a virtual check-in, this is the description, a brief 5 to 10 minute check-in with your practitioner via telephone or other telecommunications device to decide whether an office visit or other service, a remote evaluation of recorded video and or images submitted by an, why have to go all the way to a doctor's office when you could just do a video or a brief telecommunicate. I'm really happy to see it finally happening and finally becoming a part of the mainstream Medicare benefit pack. A range of healthcare providers, such as doctors, nurse practitioners, clinical psychologists, and licensed clinical social workers, will be able to offer telehealth to Medicare benefits. That's you if you are on Medicare. I say Medicare participants. Beneficiaries, though again, will be able to receive services in any healthcare facility, including a physician's office, hospital, nursing home, or rural health clinic, as well as from their homes. Let's say you've got a psychiatrist and you have weekly, maybe bi-weekly meetings with that psychiatrist. Well, now Medicare will pay the benefit, even if you don't leave your house and the psychiatrist and you chit-chat electronically. Medicare beneficiaries will be able to receive various services through telehealth, including common office visits, mental health counseling, and preventive health screenings. These flexibilities will help healthcare institutions across the nation offer some medical service remotely, so that healthcare facilities like emergency departments and doctor's offices are available to deal with the most urgent cases. This is just fantastic. I couldn't be more excited about this as a step forward. What took us as a modern, electronically plugged in to use the technology we have at our disposal to make delivery of health and to make the delivery of a doctor or nurse practitioner's advice and experience more efficient? They can help more people at less cost by communicating with them telephonically or electronically. That is the short and sweet version of telehealth and its big step forward that just occurred last month. Thank you, the Chinese virus, for pushing people to, because otherwise it might not. What do you think, Randy? Should we call your doctor and see what he has to say?
I was concerned when you were talking about how that was going to be delivered. I was just about ready that you were going to say telepathically.
That could be next.
I have many people communicating with me telepathically, but we don't talk about that.
I can help you with that situation. I have what is known as, this is kind of a technical situation, but it's basically tinfoil, and I put it on my head, and then, and then the voices stop for the most part.
Oh, my gosh. That's funny.
Folks, if you could see Randy, you could see that he just turned around and looked behind him to see if his wife was sneaking up.
You are not going to believe this, but we are out of time.
Oh, man.
We are absolutely out of time. We have had too much fun for one episode. We're going to have to land the plane, put your trays up in their upright and locked position, and as the flight attendant comes by, put your garbage in the bag.
Well, I'm a little concerned about the cobwebs I see growing on the mailbag, so I'm hoping that at some point in the near future, we'll be able to at least have an excuse to sweep those out.
We are going to make an extra effort in the next episode to get to the mailbag.
Wonderful, wonderful. In the meantime, let me plug my book, Medicare for the Lazy Man 2020. I wrote it just for you. No, not you, you. I wrote it for you to learn what you need to know about your Medicare choices in about an hour. You don't have to be a speed reader to get through it. Evelyn would probably do it in 10 minutes, but the average audience member then turns around and thanks me and says, by the way, should I do this or that? And I'm happy to respond via email. If you're so inclined, go to Amazon or barnesandnoble.com. Buy my book, Medicare for the Lazy Man 20. And we do have a couple of other interesting things. We've got this podcast and a magnificent website that Randy has designed and executed, by which we're going to be able to offer people Medicare supplement plans one day soon. Of course, we don't have an audio book.
No, man, if we had an audio book, we'd be cooking with gas.
Absolutely.
We tried to get this audio book produced and out the door, I don't know how many times. We won't name names, but it has a lot of things to do with Amazon.
And the other thing is that people are still buying last year's audiobook, which is decidedly inferior and out of date. out of frustration. These are dedicated audiobook aficionados, and we don't have a 2020 version. The newest we have is a 2019 version of the audiobook, and these poor people are still having to buy that. Has not been approved. Thanks, Chinese.
You got it. Thank you to the audience for joining us. We know you could have been 17 other places, but you chose to come spend some time with the anti-insurance insurance guy, Doug Jones, with MedicareForTheLazyMan.com.
Bye-bye.